Recently, I was in London, and I was asked to speak about this book at SOAS, the London University. And there was about 300 students and professors there. I was explaining how I hitchhiked from London to the Himalayas in India. It took about 6 months. From London, Amsterdam, Belgium, Luxembourg, France, Switzerland, Italy, Greece, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. And after the talk, people were coming up to meet me. And this very nice young girl, probably about 21 years old, British girl, she told me how fascinated she was by the talk. The reason why, she told me she was the president of the All UK Hitchhikers Society. I never heard of such a thing. And she told me she was so inspired, she wants to take a group to hitchhike from London to India. And she asked my opinion. She was very excited. She was committed, ready to go the next day, it seemed like. I gave her my opinion. I said, stand on the side of the road and hitchhike to Heathrow Airport and then take a flight to India because it's not the way it used to be. And a couple days later, I spoke at HSBC Bank in London. And there was about 900 bankers there. And I was feeling very, very shy, actually. So I prayed for something to say. And I told them, I'm feeling very honored that you have asked me to speak to you. Considering you're many of the greatest bankers in the world, and this is one of the greatest banks in the world, and to be honest with you, I have not signed a check or had a bank account since 1969, 41 years back. They looked at me like I was an alien from the most distant planet in the universe. So life really is an adventure. And then a couple days later, I was invited to speak at the House of Commons in the British Parliament. And I was standing there in this one of the parliamentary chambers where there was quite a few MPs and lords and ladies and professors, and there was a couple archbishops and priests and rabbis and like that. And I was looking around the room at the beautiful wooden carvings all over the walls, and very, very plush, soft textured wallpaper, not paper, but wall coverings and original ancient paintings. Then I looked out the window and I saw the River Thames. And beyond the River Thames, I saw a stone boundary wall. And something really hit my heart. I prayed, what am I going to say? As I was standing before them, and as I looked across the river, that boundary wall was the very spot that I used to sit for hours each night when I was 19 years old. Because my friend Gary and myself, we decided to take a summer vacation to Europe. we had a friend named Frank who promised to pay all our expenses. So we agreed to go. The first day we arrived in Luxembourg, after taking a $65 flight from New York, Frank was robbed. So he said, with nothing, we cannot stay. Let's go back. So he left, same day. And Gary and I, we looked at each other and thought, God brought us this far. Let us see where he wants to bring us next. So we had nothing. And London was a place that was such a traumatic crossroads in my life, because there was this calling in my heart for spirituality. This was in 1970. And in those days, there was what was called a counterculture. An entire generation, a movement of young people who were seeking higher realities through drugs and rock and roll and sex, free sex, and all these things. It was big in America, and it was huge in London. And I was with that crowd. And I was at such a crossroads. I had more opportunities to enjoy a sensual life than ever before. And I was free, and I was away from home, and I was a teenager. And at the same time, there was this calling. And after spending the day with all people, at night, my friend Gary and I, we slept on the basement floor of a church on Lambeth Road, where a priest let travelers stay for free. And as I was looking out that window, I saw Lambeth Road, and I saw the road where that church was. But before I would go to sleep alone, I would sit on that wall, wondering, where do I really want to go? What do I really want to do with my life? Should I go home and get a job and become wealthy, which I could have done? Should I go to school, get a PhD? Should I just be with all these hippie people and enjoy my senses, take drugs, and listen to rock and roll, and be free? Or should I follow this voice in my heart that seems to be taking me away from everything? I would sit there for hours. I was in the most confused state of my life, answering questions, and every one of those questions was going to determine my future completely. I'd look down at the River Thames, then I'd look up, right across the river was the British Parliament, lit up so beautifully. And beside it was the clock tower of Big Ben. And after crying and praying and contemplating and wondering, I would just spend hours wondering, where is the current of the river of destiny going to bring me in course of time? And as I looked across at the Parliament, for sure, I was seeing the same window from the other side that I was looking out just last year in October. These were my thoughts as I was looking into the river and looking at that wall. And I shared my thoughts with all of the assembled people. The river of destiny, where it will bring us, is a great mystery, and it's a great wonder. here I was, 41 years later, a Swami speaking inside that building. And I was thinking, what brought me here was the choices I made sitting on that wall as a penniless, homeless wanderer across from the river. And interestingly, we have a special guest here. That person who I traveled with in Europe, my lifelong friend, Gary. Would you like to stand up, Gary? It's quite miraculous, the nature of our relationship. But if you want to understand it, reading this book, The Journey Home, is required. So these are questions. In my own way, I tried to answer these questions, and I was led on a certain path. But actually, these are the same questions that people in all fields of life have been asking from the very beginning of time. What am I here for? What is really meaningful and fulfilling in life? Everyone is seeking pleasure. The Vedanta Sutra tells Anandamayo Vyashat, that the absolute truth or God is pleasure seeking, and therefore he's the reservoir of all pleasure. Therefore, every living being, we all have this in common. We're seeking fulfillment. And different people with different conditionings and different karmas are looking for fulfillment in different ways. But the little ant that is crawling on your kitchen cabinet is looking for the same thing that we are in his or her own little way. But so many times in this world, we become so caught up and distracted by things that we forget what real fulfillment is. Fulfillment to the mind and senses can come from material things. But the only thing that can bring fulfillment to the heart is love. No matter who we are or what we have, if people do not love us and we do not have people that we love, is our life meaningful? Can it be fulfilling? It's an empty shell. And we understand from the great scriptures, all the different scriptures of the world, that the origin of that propensity to love is the Atma, the living force, the soul's love for God. And the soul's experiencing the infinite, sweet love of God. And when that is awakened within our heart, then we can be an instrument of that love in every aspect of our life. This is the basic teaching of Bhagavad Gita. Yat karoshi yadashnasi, yat chohosi dadasi, yat tapasyasi konte yatat kurusha madarpanam. Whoever we are, whatever we do, whether we are doctors or lawyers or industrialists or business people or teachers or parents or students or farmers, whatever it may be, if it is done as an expression of the love of our heart, it brings real fulfillment. It brings liberation, enlightenment. In the world today, though, we are so endlessly bombarded by weapons of mass distraction. So many distractions. In an enlightened society, people love people and use things. But in an unenlightened society, which is so much influencing the world today, people use people and love things. There's no depth. There's no substance to such a life. And in order to actually experience that substance, very intelligent balance is required. Because we have so many different types of responsibilities. We have occupational duties. We have family duties, domestic duties, social duties. We have duties to our own health. And we have spiritual duties, which are foundational basis of all other duties. There's a simple analogy of a lady who has a bird cage, and she puts so much time, energy, and investment in making the cage beautiful. And one of her neighbors comes to the house, and she says, "I want you to see this cage." The neighbor is horrified. The cage has gold and silver and different types of jewels. But the bird inside is starving to death. The whole purpose of the cage is to be a nice place for the bird, but she forgot the bird. That's the story of life for the majority of human population in the world today. We become so obsessed and so distracted by so many things, but we forget who we are and what we need. This building is so nice. I think it's 9 stories. I remember some years ago, this was Kushal and Chaitanya's grandmother's house. It was 1 story. It was really nice, actually. It was a very historical house. But in a city like Bombay, sometimes there's only one way to go, and that's upward. So it's a wonderful building. And when we go into their home downstairs, we see beautiful architecture, beautiful art, beautiful furniture, beautiful cabinet work. But how many people have come to your house and said, "This has a fantastic foundation"? Foundation isn't seen, but the foundation holds everything up. Without a strong foundation, when the monsoon winds come, everything will collapse. So if we want fulfillment, it is important that we have a strong spiritual foundation in our life, where we could maintain dignity and integrity, even in the face of temptation and fear. Because we are actually experiencing a higher fulfillment within ourselves. We use things. We don't need things because we're feeling inner fulfillment. That's the purpose of religion. That's the purpose of yoga. That's the purpose of life. To actually connect or reconnect with our own spiritual essence, with the fulfillment, with the love, with the grace that is within us. And then through our business, through our parenthood, through our studies, through our social interactions, we don't need to take things to find satisfaction. But rather, whatever we're doing is an expression of the love, the peace, the grace, and the happiness that we have discovered within ourselves. Mr. Somaya and Mrs. Somaya, they are two of the great educators of this world. Somaya College is integrating spiritual as well as academic values, which I'm so proud to see. Education comes from the Latin word educare, which means to bring out what is within. It doesn't mean to superimpose all sorts of data on our brain. It means to bring out what is already within us, to be an instrument. Then there can be real fulfillment, deep fulfillment. And spiritual practice is meant for this purpose, to create this foundation. In this modern world, in a city like Mumbai, there's so much stress. Now, I'm a Swami, so I don't know that much about all of the different, pressures of the world. But from another perspective, almost everybody I talk to tells me. So I do know a lot. Recently, last year, I spoke in many different parts of America. And a few of the places, I'm just telling you about this because they gave me the subjects to speak about. When I was going to churches or synagogues or yoga studios, they would ask me to speak about enlightenment and transformation of consciousness. And when I would go to universities, so many universities, they would give me more academic kind of subjects that were integrated with spirituality. But when I spoke at the headquarters of Apple and Ford Motor Company and Oracle and Starbucks, they all gave me the same subject, how to deal with stress. So I was thinking, this corporate world must really be stressed out because they weren't talking to each other. It was very relevant to them. And when they made that subject, it attracted a lot of employees. How to somehow deal with stress. If you have a strong foundation, you could transform stress into something beautiful. Spirituality is the science of learning how to take anything that may come in this world and utilize it to grow in wisdom, in love, and in realization. A runner, they run. And the more they make the more they put stress on their lungs and on their legs, and they get tired and it's pumping and pumping, the faster and more endurance they get. Without stress, they won't improve. A weightlifter, according to the stress, you know, if you look at Gary, you'll see subjects himself to incredible amounts of stress. But it makes you strong when you learn how to manage stress properly. But if you don't, it could tear your muscles and break your limbs. So stress has its purpose if we just know how to use it. I remember after I hadn't seen Gary in 18 years. We had no communication. And somehow or other, we met. It was quite miraculous how we met. I was on my way to Big Sur in California to give a lecture at the Benedictine Christian Monastery with Father Bede Griffiths. And we stopped for gasoline, petrol, in Malibu, California. And somehow or other, we were driving up Highway 1. I met Gary. He looked completely different. The last time I saw him, he was skinnier than me. And I had long hair, and now I'm shaved. I looked more strange than he looked. And I'm in robes as a swami. And Gary was a physical trainer at the Malibu gym, giving physical fitness lessons and teaching people how to use all those machines and weights to Hollywood people and all these different LA people. And we got to talking to try to catch up on our lives. And at one point, Gary said to me, "How could we still be friends? We have nothing in common." My whole life is to teach people that if they have a strong, beautiful, handsome body, they will be happy. And your whole life is teaching people to understand that they are not their body at all, that they're eternal souls, and when they nourish their soul, they'll be happy. What do we have in common? Do you remember that question, Gary? So I said another little prayer, and the answer I gave was, my Guru Srila Prabhupada, he would tell us that the body is a temple of God. So you teach people how to keep their temple really nice, and I'll try to tell them what to do inside the temple, and we could work together. And ever since that day, we've worked together. The integration of the physical, the emotional, and the spiritual is a fulfilling life. These bodies are sacred if we understand them in reference to our love and our service to God. Recently, I was at a funeral. One of my students passed away, and I was putting his ashes in the Ganga in Navadweep in Bengal just a few days ago. And his mother, he was an American boy. His mother, his father, his brother, his friends, they were all there. And I was expressing how the soul is eternal. The Gita tells us, nahanyate hanyamani sarire, the soul, there's no birth, there's no death. It is transcendental to all the dualities and all the changes of this world. And the body, it is destined to die. Actually, the body never dies, because the body was actually never alive. It's the soul that's alive. The body is like a car. And just like you're looking through the windshield of your car, you're looking through your eyes. And just like you make noise by pressing the horn, in India, people are very fond of pressing horns. The same reflex we use in America to touch the brake, in India, they touch the horn. That's my realization. But so we make sounds too. But it's the driver making the sounds. There can be no action in the car without a driver. But the car is as sacred as the purpose in which it's used for. So as long as this body is connected to the soul, it has a very wonderful purpose potentially. I may not be able to see your soul, but I know your soul is there. It's the living force. It's the real you. And I could serve God within your heart by serving your body. I could relate to you as a spirit soul through your body. And I could relate to you through my body. So the body is a precious medium. And therefore it's our duty to keep it as best as we can. Not as an egoistic thing. But if we have a good foundation, we use it as an instrument, to be an instrument of grace, of love, of positive change within this world. The potential within everyone is unlimited. Because everyone is part of God. We are all unlimited. And the potential is not in our power or in our strength. The potential is our potential and our capacity to love, to be an instrument of Krishna's infinite love. And when we understand this, and when we strive to reconnect with this treasure that is within us, then we're not ordinary anymore. This is the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. On one hand, we have Duryodhana, who was driving a chariot, who was fighting with arrows and clubs, who was organizing militaries. And on the other hand, we have Yudhisthira and Arjuna, who are on chariots and fighting with clubs and arrows and organizing military strategies. Apparently, if you just don't know anything about what's in their hearts, they're both doing exactly the same thing. But their consciousness was completely different. Duryodhana was driving his chariot to fulfill his envy, his ego, and his greed. And Arjuna was doing exactly the same thing, out of love, compassion, and devotion. What makes a person happy? Not what we do, but the purpose, the spirit in which we do it. And that is something every human being has the power to choose. Are we going to be servants of our greed, our envy, our anger, our kama? Or are we going to be servants of God's compassion? Same thing. We may make the same amount. We may do the same thing. We may be in the same place. Spirituality, yoga, bhakti, it's not about necessarily changing our position. It's about changing our consciousness. I'll end with one little story. Years ago, I was in Mumbai, and I was speaking, I don't remember the name of it, but it is a college for accountants. And there was about 300 students in this auditorium. They were all studying how to be accountants. And I gave a talk. I don't remember what I said. I was giving a particular subject. And afterward, I asked if there was any questions. Now, in universities, you have to be quite ready for anything when you ask the students for questions. So this one boy raised his hand and I called on him. He stood up. As soon as he stood up, almost everyone in the room went, "Ooh." And I realized this person is very charismatic, very popular, very influential. And I was waiting. He screamed at me at the top of his voice, and it was loud. He said, "You are a cheater. You have simply come to mislead us. I reject everything you have said to us." He said, "What if everyone in the world became a swami like you? Who would grow the food? Who would do the banking? Who would do the trading? Who would run the governments? Who would educate our children? Therefore, I have to reject whatever you have said." He got a standing ovation. It lasted a long time, too. The students were on their feet, and they were clapping, and they were cheering, and they were howling to celebrate that he just, what to say, he was victorious over the Swami. So after this quieted down, I said a little prayer. "Krishna, please tell me what to say." And sometimes Krishna gives me good things to say. And sometimes he leaves me to just make a fool out of myself. But in this case, I answered the question. I said, "Sir, what would happen if everyone in the world became an accountant like you? Who would do the farming and grow the food? Who would do the banking? Who would educate our children? Who would run the governments? In fact, if everybody became an accountant like you, there would be no need for accountants, so there would be 100% unemployment in this world." I said, "The reality is there is a need for farmers, and there's a need for business people and industrialists, and there's need for scientists, and there's need for teachers, and there's need for farmers, and there's need for accountants, and there's some need for little swamis like me too. We all have a purpose. Just like this body. The different organs and limbs of the body, they have different colors, different shapes, and completely different purposes." Yes? The kidneys cannot do what the ear does. The heart cannot do what the feet do. The eyes cannot do what the lungs do. Yes? But it's not that the ears are telling the knees that you are lower than me. Every part of the body is honoring, respecting, and appreciating the service of every other part of the body, and they are all doing very unique, special features. And because they're working together in harmony, in appreciation, and cooperation, the body is healthy. The social body of humanity, there are many occupations, varnashram dharma, there are different positions in life on so many levels. But when we learn the spiritual principle of appreciating the Atma, the spiritual essence within each other, when we understand it within ourselves, we can appreciate it in others. If we don't understand it in ourselves, we cannot really appreciate it in others. So let us appreciate each other and learn to work together and do something wonderful for this world. I'm a little ashamed to say it, but I got a louder standing ovation than he did. And he went like this and sat down. This is the all-important factor of life, that we do come out from the mediocre, apparently ordinary syndrome of just trying to make a living, trying to become famous, trying to become great. There's nothing wrong with those things. But unless it's built on a foundation of integrity, of inner satisfaction, and ultimately of love for Krishna, love for God, then our true great potential is wasted. This beautiful chanting is simple and profoundly powerful way of awakening that inner essence, that love that is within our hearts. Just like on a television, there's different frequencies that tune you into different stations. When I was young, living in Chicagoland, 30 miles north of Chicago, there were 4 television stations. CBS, ABC, NBC, and an educational station called WTTW. Gary remembers. And if you wanted to change the channel, you had to get up from your bed, walk across the room, and turn a dial. And there were these antennas that went like this, and you'd have to move it around, otherwise it was all... Now, so much progress we've made, you can sit in your bed and just press a button, and there's some places over 100 stations. You press one, and it's a cricket match in Australia. You press another, and it's news from Baghdad. And you press another, and there's a Bollywood movie with all these people dancing around and singing songs. And you press another one, and there's some Swami speaking. So many stations. What's incredible about this is, how is it that instantly at the press of a button, you just tune into something completely different? It's not that you requisition it. You send an email, send me this show, and, in 1 week it will come on my television. Instantly you just press it, it's there. That means the vibration is everywhere. And you just have to, according to what you tune into, you get that frequency. Life in this world, it's about what we tune into. So many people are tuning into the frequency of insatiable greed, insatiable lust, insatiable arrogance. And when it's unfulfilled, anger and envy. All those things are everywhere. And if we tune into that, there's an abundance that's going to affect and influence our minds. But there's another frequency that is everywhere. The frequency of grace. God's grace. Which has the power to heal, to restore, to enliven. To unveil our own eternal blissful nature and make us an instrument of that. So our spiritual practice is tuning into the frequency of that grace in the path of bhakti. Because in different spiritual practices, there's different spiritual frequencies people turn into. Some people try to turn into the frequency of getting siddhis or supernatural powers. Others try to turn into the frequency of peace. stillness. In bhakti, we want to tune into this frequency of grace. Because we believe beyond peace, beyond powers, is love. And it's only the frequency of grace that can awaken that love within our hearts and to make us an instrument of that love. And once we tune in, then we become like towers that emit those. We become like little antennas ourselves. And that grace comes through our every word, our every thought, our every action in whatever we do. And then our inner full potential is truly being utilized. And we can be happy. This kirtan, this chanting of God's names, is a profound way of tuning in to the all-pervading energy of grace and awakening our spiritual potential. Thank you very much. If anyone would like to ask any questions or speak anything, I will be honored to try to answer. Thank you.
Any questions?
That was a wonderful talk, Swamiji. I have only one question. The quest for love, how should we deal with people who clearly are out to cheat the world, you know, clearly are more towards evil than good? What should be our attitude towards them?
They will always be around. You see, to a certain extent, we have the power to change our environment. But ultimately, it's very limited. We may not be able to change the whole world or how people think or how people act or why people do what they do. Of course, we can try our best to help. But there's one thing that we could always change, and that's ourself. If we live by the power, if we live with that potential of devotion, if we carry God's grace in our lives and express it through what we do, that's the greatest way in which we can influence others. And there will be many, many people you do seriously influence, and other people you may not be able to influence so much. But you could be transcendental to that. We cannot always change everything in this world, but we can change ourselves. And that gives us the greatest strength to be an instrument of change. So how to deal with people like that? There are certain universal laws of spirituality. It is said we should hate the disease, but not the diseased. Aham bija pratapita. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells, I am the father and mother of every living being. Krishna tells. So that means everyone is our brother and sister. Everyone is inherently divine. Everyone is a part of God. But due to the disease of the ahankar, of the ego, one becomes incriminated in ever-increasing bondage of lust and envy and anger and pride and greed. And one becomes a servant of these things. If our mother is sick, we hate the disease, but we love our mother. So when our brothers and sisters, in the form of whoever they may be in this world, when they're, we should see that when they're acting in such a cruel, evil, or selfish way, it's the symptom of a terrible disease. If we see it that way, instead of hating them, we'll actually feel compassion for them. At the same time, we have to do the needful. We can't let them cheat us. We can't let them hurt us. Arjuna was fighting, but he was fighting out of compassion. He wasn't fighting out of arrogance or anger or greed. And it puts a whole different perspective in life. To feel compassion for a diseased person is an expression of love. To feel hate for a diseased person, that hate burns our heart. It doesn't heal our heart. And if we have that spiritual foundation, we can actually deal with people like that. Whether we fight with them or not, that's according to the need. But even if we do, it's not with arrogance or greed, it's with compassion. Does that answer your question? It's actually quite easy. It's just mindset change. And where there is some satsang associating with people who have that state of mind, it becomes very possible and accessible.
Thank you. Swamiji, that was really, really excellent lecture. Just one small point. How would you define the difference between a religion and spirituality?
If we try to understand the actual meaning of religion, there's no difference. But if we view the way religion is often followed in this world today, there's a big difference. The word religion comes from the Greek word religio, which means to bind back, to reconnect. To reconnect our heart, our consciousness with God. That's what religion means. The word yoga in Sanskrit means exactly the same thing. To reunite, to reconnect the soul with the Atma with the Paramatma. Our consciousness with the Supreme, with God, to reconnect our consciousness with each other through our connection with God, Bhagavan. So they mean the same thing. Religion is the path of purification. We understand that love of God is dormant within the heart of everyone. It's just like you have a mirror. When you look in the mirror, you're supposed to see yourself. But if the mirror is covered with dirt and dust and pollution and all sorts of other coverings, then all you see is the dust and the dirt and the pollution. And you think that that's me. The mind is like a mirror. When the mind is clean, the soul looks at the world through the mind. When the mind is clean, we see
we see Krishna, the all-beautiful, all-loving object of our love, and we see our own eternal soul as the lover of Krishna. But when it's covered by all this arrogance and greed and envy and passion, we think, that's me. What is religion? Religion doesn't mean to be a Christian or a Jew or a Hindu or a Jain or a Parsi or a Sikh or a, what else? So many others. Religion means to love God. Religion means to clean the heart and be able to perceive the love of God that is within you. My Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, he would say like that, that real religion is not being about being a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Jain or a Sikh or a Parsi or anything else. Real religion is about awakening love of God. And the first commandment of the Bible is to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And if you love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, what comes next? Naturally, spontaneously, we love our neighbor as ourself. And every living being is our neighbor. Not only all castes and all nationalities and all sexes of human society, but the animals and the birds and the fish. Wherever there's life, life is sacred. Every living being is our neighbor. Because every living being is a part of God. We naturally love our neighbor as ourself. That's religion. Krishna tells in Gita, sarva dharman parityaja mam ekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha ishami masaja. He says, abandon all varieties of dharma. Sometimes dharma is translated as religion. And just surrender to me. What does surrender to me? It doesn't mean surrendering in defeat. The mother surrenders to the baby, doesn't she? In the middle of the night when the mother's sleeping and the baby goes, ah! The mother surrenders to the baby. She gets up to take care of the child. That's not surrender of defeat. That's the surrender of love, unselfish love. To surrender in love to God and to be an instrument of God's love in this world, that is religion. That is spirit. That is the essence of religion, and that is the essence of spirituality. As far as the various rituals, there's so many different language. There's so many different forms of ritual. And when we become attached to those things and forget what it's for, it becomes what today's known as religion. For there's so many differences. You know, I'm doing puja. But what are we doing puja for? Do we really know what it is? It's meant to tune us in to the grace of God. It's meant to focus on the divine power of God's love. We can study scriptures. I've seen people who have studied scriptures and who memorize thousands and thousands of slokas. But their ego and their envy and their greed is as much as anybody else. What is it for? The purpose of studying scripture, the purpose of puja, mantra, yantra, tantra, puja, mudra, the purpose of all these things is just to clean the mirror of the mind and reconnect us to the divine grace. Saragrahi, Saragrahi means one who seeks the essence. That is real religion, to seek the essence of spirituality and religion. Then we see what is in common. In this Journey Home book, I give one analogy. When I was living in Patna, at the collectory ghat, there was the person asking the question is from Patna, yes? Yeah, so it's a good analogy for you. At the collectory ghat in Patna, I was living with this very old Swami. I was 20 years old at the time. And the Swami was Ram Sevak Swami. He was about 85. And there was another man who was over 85. His name was Narayan Prasad. And he used to translate for me every day because nobody else spoke English except him. And every day about 11 o'clock in the morning, he took me to his best friend. His best friend lived at the Magadha X-ray clinic, and his name was Mohammed. He was Islamic. And interesting, Narayan Prasad would speak to him about Bhagavad Gita, and Mohammed would speak to him about the Quran. And I would speak about all the different stuff that I knew. One day I was just sitting alone with Narayan Prasad on the bank of the Ganga. And I asked him, how is it in a place like India where there's so much conflict between Hindus and Muslims that you and Muhammad are best friends and you're sharing each other's scriptures like this? He said, if a dog has a master, the dog will recognize the master in whatever way the master dresses. Sometimes he may be in a suit and tie. Sometimes he may be in t-shirt and jeans. Sometimes he may be wearing a dhoti or a lungi. Sometimes he may not be wearing anything. But the dog will recognize. If we cannot recognize our beloved Lord when he comes in different times, in different dresses, with different names, then we're less than the dog. Saragrahi, to seek the essence. Even though there may be differences, if we seek the essence, we'll understand what we really have in common. And then there's no difference between spirituality and religion. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Swamiji. Question I have is, how do you resolve the conflict which sometimes occurs between peace within and peace around you?
Can you be a little more?
Yeah, you know, it's one thing to be at peace with yourself, but it may not be something which is probably acceptable to people around you in all circumstances. So what do you think should take priority? Your inner self being at peace, or is it more important that people around you and the world around you is more at peace?
Both are important. To the degree we try to create peace around us, we will find peace within ourselves. And to the degree we find peace within ourselves, we will actually have the power to create peace around us. Just like if you don't eat, you won't have the strength to do your work. So somehow or other, however busy you are, you find some time to eat food. Yes? So similarly, however busy we are, if we actually want to have a qualitatively healthy life and make positive changes around us in the environment, we have to have inner strength. Satsang, kirtan, meditation, these spiritual practices are like food that give us spiritual nourishment and strength that equip us to actually be more effective in creating peace in the environment around us. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Swamiji, for a very enlightening evening. I wanted to ask, I guess we are all made for a purpose. We have a life for a purpose. But if you're at a confused state of life, how would a person really know what your purpose in life is?
Confusion is a blessing. Because when we're confused, it shakes us from our complacency and we start asking the questions that you're asking today. And this is the basis of Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna was in total illusion. Yes? And then he became extremely confused. He thought his illusion was truth. The Bhagavad Gita begins where Arjuna is telling Krishna why he will not fight and he cannot fight. And he had such good logic, such good scientific, philosophical, socialistic reasons. But ultimately, all of his reasoning couldn't really save him from distress because the nature of the world, things just happen that we just don't want to happen. But it's going to happen anyway. It's the nature of this place. Then Arjuna was confused. And in his confusion, he turned to God. Karpanya doso bahata svabhava prichchami tvam dharma samudacheha. Now I'm bewildered. I'm confused. I don't know what is to be done and what is not to be done. Please instruct me. Confusion can shake us from our complacent comfort zone. And that's oftentimes what we need to grow. To grow beyond from where we are. And in that confusion, we seek answers. And when we seek it in satsang, in the association of saintly people, spiritual literatures, in the name of God, then we can find the real faith, the real conviction, the real realization that forever frees us from this confusion. So confusion is a blessing if we respond accordingly.
Swamiji, how do you strike a balance between performing your duties and pursuance of bliss, as you talk about? Are they two separate things? Or are we, by performing our duties and striving to be good and certain principles in life, we are going towards the bliss also? Or do we need to do something extra? There are two different things.
We shouldn't worry about peace so much. Mm. We should focus more on love than peace. We were using the example of the baby crying. Does the mother want to be in peace? or does the mother want to satisfy the child? Which is a higher principle? Being in peace while this child is suffering? Or giving up our peace for the higher purpose of love? When what we do is motivated by love, by compassion, it's a higher, deeper experience than peace. It's a deeper peace. Little Prahlad Maharaj, he was 5 years old. And we all know the story how his father was throwing him down pits of snakes and throwing him in fire and throwing him off mountains and throwing him in the bottom of oceans and feeding him fire and poison. And little Prahlad, he was just remembering Krishna. Marid, that Krishna, if you want to kill me, I'm ready to go. And if you want to protect me, then what can anybody do to me? I'm yours. He just gave his heart. That was his peace. And after Hiranyakashipu was liberated, Narasimhadev, the Lord, offered Prahlad any benediction. He said, I have the power to give you anything you want. You endured so much for me. I want to give you something in return. And little Prahlad said, if I'm going to take anything in return for my devotion to you, then I'm not a devotee. I'm a businessman. I'm giving, expecting something in return. I'm your devotee. Devotee means I'm giving and I don't want anything but to give more. But if you insist on giving me something, I ask for two things. Do you remember those two things? He said, my father, who was so cruel, not only did he commit every type of sinful activity to try to murder me, but he did murder so many other people. He hated me more than anything. Give me this benediction. Liberate my father and forgive him. And the second thing Prahlad asked for, he said, as long as there's anyone in this world who's suffering due to forgetfulness of you, let me be in this world to help them out of that situation, even if I have to suffer. He wasn't asking for peace. He was asking for seva, because seva is based on love. So yes, we want peace, but this kind of peace, the peace of being an instrument of love. And that's within all of us. It is our potential. Does that answer your question?
Yes. The service is the most important. Seva.
Seva is where the deepest peace is.
I agree.
And right. Even if it takes going through agitations to do it, that's a higher peace than not doing it.
If it's
based on love.
I got it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Maharaj, for this wonderful lecture and giving us enlightenment. There are no more questions. Dinner is served, and I'm sure Maharaj will be open to meeting with him and discussing with him anything else that you'd like to. Also, after dinner, there's copies of Maharaj's book journey home in case any of you would like to pick it up. And there are some CDs also put together by some devotees who Maharaj inspired to, you know, they were young college kids, all fond of music. So they've actually put a CD together called The Orange Light. And so those CDs are available also, so please take a copy with you as you go. Thank you so much, Maharaj. Dinner is served. Hare Krishna.
It's such a great pleasure and such an enriching blessing upon my life to spend these moments with all of you. Nupur made me promise I wouldn't speak about them, so I'm not going to break the promise too much. But they are two of the most beautiful people in the world. I know Kushal since he's a little boy. And when he was going to college, I remember when he was a little boy, he loved cows. He was very fond of cows. Love to see cows. And when he was going to college at University of Pennsylvania, whenever possible, when I was traveling in America, I would from time to time take a train from New York City to Washington, D.C., where I'd be giving lectures, and I would stop. What was the name of the station? The 30th Street Station. And I would bring prasad for Kushal. And we'd sit in the station on the seats for sometimes 2-3 hours, yes? And then I'd get on the next train and he would get on a bus and go back to school. And beautiful days. And Nupur, anybody I've ever met that has met her, their life is never the same. So I want to thank you. And I know for sure whoever your dear friends are must be the most beautiful people in the world. That is why it's such an honor to meet all of you. Thank you very much. And I'm sure they've arranged super excellent prasad also.